Joshua chapter 10. We're continuing to look at the book of Joshua as guidelines for us on how we are to fight the battles of life by faith, walking by faith into the promises of God that He has given to us, and we are dealing with battles all around us. Do you go through battles? Are you like me? Do you have battles? Are there battles with sin? Are there battles with the enemy? Are there battles, you know, with the world? Are there things that come against you and you feel like you're just being barraged constantly? Are there temptations that are you know, trying to get you off course and so forth? I hope I'm not the only one. I know I'm not the only one. I'm not that insecure. I know that everybody struggles in these same ways. This is what the book of Joshua is telling us. It's what it's giving us insights into. How to fight these battles. How to stand. How to walk by faith. How to walk in the victory that is given to us through Jesus Christ. And to walk out those promises. And every single chapter we've looked at here in Joshua has given us new insights and new understanding about those battles. The kind of challenges that come our way and how to fight them. And we've been learning a lot about keeping our eyes on Jesus. Not allowing prayerlessness or neglect of prayer into our lives, not becoming self-sufficient, self-confident, and thinking we got this thing all dialed in and we know how this works, and staying humble, staying connected, you know, to the Lord. Remember way back, at pretty much the beginning of the book of Joshua, where before they actually began any of their attacks, they had just crossed the Jordan. Remember when they got to Gilgal? Remember what Gilgal stood for? It was the place where God, you know, they were all ready to attack. In fact, that chapter, which was chapter 5, it's talked about how, you know, all the kings and all the people of the Canaan were just, their hearts were melting with fear because of the Israelites. And we talked about how, boy, that's the time to attack, you know, attack. And God says, yeah, we got some unfinished business we got to take care of. Remember, that's when Joshua, you know, made flint knives and they had neglected the rite of circumcision. And so He said, I want you to circumcise the men. And then they had a time of commemorating God's faithfulness. Remember, they built that altar with stones from the Jordan and they put it up and they even plastered it. They put plaster on it and they inscribed the words of the law on it. And they said, this altar is an altar of remembrance. And so Gilgal is all about remembering and recommitting and the cutting away of the flesh. And then they celebrated the Passover at Gilgal, remember? And they reminded themselves of God's deliverance. And of course, that beautiful picture that Passover is of the blood of the Lamb being shed to save us from death, which of course points toward Jesus. But that's what Gilgal is all about. One of the things you may not realize is that during this course into the Promised Land, they've stayed camped in Gilgal. And that has been their center, their headquarters. And when they go out from Gilgal. And when they come back to Gilgal. And we're going to see that here in this chapter too. They go from Gilgal into the battle, they come back to Gilgal. And remember, Gilgal is that place of remembrance, that place of recommitment, that place of reflection, remembrance. All those things. To you and I, that place, that Gilgal, you know, is the cross. That's where we reflect, isn't it? We come back to the cross. And we remember what Jesus did for us. We remember that He not only died for our sins, but the cross reminds us that we died with Him, right? And we're reminded of the fact that we died with Christ. And our lives are not our own. Now they belong to Him. So just as the Israelites started off every battle from Gilgal and then came back to Gilgal after the battle was over, so we as Christians need to start off from our place of Gilgal, the cross. Before we go into any battle, boy, make sure you start at the cross. And then when you get done with that battle, you come back to the cross. You come back to your Gilgal. It's very, very important. That's what we're going to see here. Now it says here in verse 1 of chapter 10 that as soon as Adonai Zedek, who was king of Jerusalem, heard how Joshua had captured Ai and had devoted it to destruction, doing to Ai and its king as he had done to Jericho and its king, and how the inhabitants of Gibeon had made peace with Israel and were among them, and we We saw that last week in the last chapter. The Gibeonites, remember, had deceived the Israelites to make a pact of peace, a treaty with them. It says in verse 2 that Adonizedek feared greatly. Well, why? Here's why. Because Gibeon was a great city. In fact, it says it was like one of the royal cities, meaning that it was probably in charge of a whole regional area. And that other cities were in its wake, if you will. And we learned that actually last week. And because it was greater than Ai and all its men were warriors. So, you know, we learned something interesting here about Gibeon. The men of Gibeon were not wimps. It says here they were great warriors. That's one of the reasons Adonizedek was worried about this, because he thought, you know what? We just lost an ally. We lost a powerful ally in fighting against the Israelites and trying to put up some kind of a defense against their, you know, coming into the land, because the Gibeonites defected basically and they went over to the side of the Israelites. And he may not even know the circumstances of how that all came about. All he knows is it happened. But here, isn't it interesting here that we learn that the Gibeonites were mighty warriors. What does that tell you? You see, it wasn't because they were afraid necessarily, or that they couldn't fight a battle, that they came to Joshua and tried to, but actually succeeded in getting him to sign a kind of a peace treaty with them. It wasn't because they were wimps, because they realized this God cannot be beaten on a battlefield. They probably had, if they were mighty warriors, they probably had their share of successes on the battlefield. But they knew this God couldn't be beat. This is not the kind of a God you want to take up into battle. And so they came, and we talked about this last week. They came and they made this thing of peace with the Israelites. So, and by the way, it's interesting we're hearing about Jerusalem, isn't it, in this particular passage. It says that the king of Jerusalem, now, it's interesting, Jerusalem as a city technically is not going to be inhabited by Israelites until many years later, after the time of the judges, after the time of King Saul. It's not until the time of King David. David is actually going to take the city of Jerusalem. They obviously conquered the king of Jerusalem, or they're going to in this chapter, but they never actually occupied the city. And so some of the Canaanites who were left in the area went back and took up the occupation in that city until many, many, many years later, David came and actually conquered it. And so it was named the City of David, because he then made his throne there in Jerusalem. But so the Gibeonites, the king Adonizedek is thinking about this, and he's thinking, you know, This is not good. This is not good that the Gibeonites have gone over to the Israelites. And so it says in verse 3 that Adonizedek, king of Jerusalem, sent to Hoham, king of Hebron, to Piram, king of Jarmuth, and to Japhia, king of Lachish, and to Debir, king of Eglon, saying, "Come up to me and help me, and let us strike Gibeon, for it has made peace with Joshua and with the people of Israel." And so what he is doing is he's proposing that, along with four other kings, that they create this confederacy to come against Israel. And they basically he's thinking, you know, we probably can't stand against Israel by ourselves. Let's come together. Let's join forces. Surely we will be strong enough, but let's begin. Let's begin by taking Gibeon. And this was a strategic move on their part. Remember, it said Gibeon was one of the royal cities. It was like one of the royal cities. It was a key city. And it was a city that they needed to keep Canaan defensible. So to go and take Gibeon would be to establish a greater central place of defense against the invading Israelite army. Plus, they wanted to get back at the Gibeonites for defecting. Plus, they probably wanted to send a message to any other Canaanites who might be thinking of doing the same, to say, in essence, this is what happens to people who defect. So it tells us in verse 5 that then the five kings of the Amorites, the kings of Jerusalem, the king of Hebron, the king of Jarmuth, the king of Lachish, and the king of Eglon, gathered their forces and went up with their armies and encamped against Gibeon, and made war against it. And the men of Gibeon sent to Joshua at the camp at Gilgal, saying, "Do not relax your hand from your servants. Come up to us quickly and save us and help us, for all the kings of the Amorites who dwell in the hill country are gathered against us." They want help. These five kings come and literally encamp around them. And so they see this happening, so they send a messenger and they say, "Run, like your life depends on it. And run to Gilgal and tell Joshua, you know, we made a covenant of peace with you. Now you come and protect us." So this is what they're going to do. Verse 7 says, "So Joshua went up from Gilgal, he and all the people of war with him, and all the mighty men of valor. And the Lord said to Joshua, 'Do not fear them, for I've given them into your hands. Not a man of them shall stand before you.'" Which gives us the sense that Joshua prayed. I think he's learned about the whole idea of not praying before you go into war. And so he prays, and you know, it doesn't say that he prays, but you know, I think the fact that the Lord speaks to him here infers that he prayed, he went to the Lord, and so forth. And you know, you want to go to the Lord before you go up against five kings. You know? It's like, okay, five kings, all right, God, is this what we're doing? And the other thing that probably caused him to take extra time and take time to pray was that, remember now, the reason these five kings have gathered together is because Joshua kind of muffed it a little bit with the whole Gibeonite debacle. You know, he messed up. Let's make no mistake about it. He made a mistake. They should have consulted the Lord. And had they consulted the Lord, the whole Gibeonite thing never would have happened. But now because of this mistake, these other kings are coming together in this confederacy and saying, "We're going to stand against Israel." So Joshua is probably thinking to himself, "You know, this looks like something that I caused. This looks like something that my mistake caused." Have you ever seen that in your own life? Have you ever looked at your life and you've seen a circumstance that you're facing, you thought, "Okay, because of my mistake, this is now in front of me. This is the situation that's in front of me. And it's worse now. It's five times worse. Whereas we were originally going to go up against these cities one by one, now, five of these kings have come together, they've gathered together, and they are standing opposed to us. My problem just got five times worse." You know? And why? Why is it five times worse? Because I made a mistake. Well, this is when the enemy loves to come in and say, "Oh man, what a mess up you are. Look what you got yourself into." And then he'll say this, "You know, because this is your mistake, you have no right to go to God for help. Because you got yourself into this, you need to get yourself out." But that, brothers and sisters, is the voice of the enemy. Make no mistake about it. That is the voice of the evil one. And you want to hear the voice of God? The voice of God is in verse 8. Look at it again. "And the Lord said to Joshua, 'Do not fear them, for I have given them into your hands. Not a man of them shall stand before you.'" Wow. What a wonderful word from the Lord, especially on the heels of a mistake. You know, right after a mistake. Look what the Lord is doing. What is God doing? You guys know how this chapter goes. I'm assuming there's none of you who are sitting on the edge of your seat tonight. You know how this chapter goes. You know, Israel is going to go on and they're going to, you know, conquer these kings. Here's the point. God is going to take their mistake and he's going to use it in their favor. He's actually going to use it in their favor to gather five kings at once and give them victory in one shot. And those of you who know what's coming up in the chapter, you're going to also know that God also did it with miracles. Isn't that interesting? About the time, you know, when we've made about as many mistakes as we think we possibly can and still have any sense of the love of God left in our life, God blows the top off the whole thing by not only answering our prayer, but doing it miraculously. This grace of God just comes flowing out of his heart toward us. And not only does he bless us, he blesses us in an overflowing sort of a way. Has that happened to you before? I have to be careful how I say this, but I will say it, and I've said it to you many times before. I have seen some of the greatest blessings from the hand of God directly on the heels of some of my most serious mistakes. And that, people, is not God soft-pedaling my sin. That is God exalting His grace, His mercy, and His tender-heartedness. And that's what we're seeing here. So we need to remember something. And remember this when the enemy comes to you, when you've made that mistake or mistakes and begins to kind of pummel you about him and make you feel like, you know, you're the lowest dog, you know, that there ever was. And why would God ever even think of helping you since you've made these kinds of mistakes? You just remember something, that no mistake is final for the devoted believer in Jesus Christ. I believe that with all my heart. God can use even our blunders for His purposes, and we need to always remember and never forget Romans 8:28 that says, we know that for those who love God, all things work together for good, for those who are called according to His purpose. God is bigger than your mistakes. If God isn't, then you serve a very small God. But God is bigger than your mistakes. God is bigger than the sum of your mistakes. Okay? He is bigger. And your mistakes do not cause God to sit back and wring His hands in anxiety and worry and wonder, how in the world is my will ever going to possibly be accomplished now that you've done this? You've ruined everything. Even though the enemy would get you to focus so much on your mistake that that's the way it appears. God wants you to know that that's not the case. Now, that doesn't give us a recklessness toward mistakes. It doesn't give us an attitude of, gee, I might as well go ahead and make mistakes because God's grace abounds to those who make mistakes. It doesn't work that way. We still have a heart and desire to live obediently to the Lord our God. But when we do make mistakes, when we blunder, we know that God is bigger. So let's see just how big God is. Verse 9. So Joshua came upon them suddenly, having marched all night from Gilgal. That's, I don't know, would you do that with your army? If you're going to go up against five kings, would you march all night long? I probably wouldn't, unless I was marching by faith. And Joshua is marching by faith. Let's make no mistake about it. Remember and do not forget what God said to him in the previous verse. He said, don't worry. I have given them, all of them, into your hands. So how does that kind of affect Joshua? Well, he realizes that the battle is the Lord's, right? The battle belongs to the Lord. So let's go. So guys, we're going to leave. What time are we going to leave? Well, let's leave at sundown or whatever, you know? And we're going to march all night long. Somebody's like, hey, aren't we going to get tired when we get there? You know what? The Lord has given them into our hands. He will sustain us. The battle belongs to Him. So they march all night long, and the Lord, it says, verse, look at this. First, this is the first thing the Lord did. And the Lord threw them into a panic before Israel, who struck them with a great blow at Gibeon and chased them by the way of the ascent of Beth Horon, which is the house of Horon, and struck them as far as Azekah and Makeda. And as they fled before Israel while they were going down the ascent of Beth Horon, the Lord threw down large stones, which we find out at the end of this verse are actually hailstones, from heaven on them as far as Azekah, and they died. And it says that there were more who died because of the hailstones than the sons of Israel killed with the sword. Do you see the first two miracles? Once again, remember I said God not only promises victory, he doesn't say to them, all right, here's the deal. This is all kind of because of your mess up. I want to remind you of that, Josh. So here's the deal. I'll give you victory. But you're going to have to work for it. And I mean work for it. So let's start by marching all night long. And then you better be on your face before me. And you better be praying without ceasing because, you know, I can be a little peevish from time to time. And if I feel like it, I might just withdraw myself from you. And God doesn't do that, does he? Look what he's doing. Look what he's doing. You know, he says to them, not only I've given them into your hands, once they get there, all they got to do is show up. And instantly, the whole five kingdom confederation of soldiers has this collective panic attack, right? Where they start hyperventilating and freaking out, and then if that isn't enough, you know, for them to take advantage of this thing, they start running, right? These guys are like, get out of here, run for your lives, and they start running, and there's this hailstorm that happens, and it says that these hailstones killed more of the enemy than the Israelites did. That's a miracle. People might say, well, you know, wait a minute here. Hold the phone just a minute. A hailstorm is not a miracle. Because I've seen hailstorms, and I've even seen hailstorms that could hurt men. And actually, I have too. You know, this last May when we were in Minnesota, I took pictures of the hailstones. We pulled our trailer out there this last May, and we no sooner had gotten to Sue's mom's, and the sky got dark. And you know, Minnesota is known for, you know, it's the top of Tornado Alley after all. And it got really dark, and then it started raining, and then it started hailing, and the hail was absolute. You know, it was like, you know, ping pong ball size hail. Put a hole in the top of one of my vents in my trailer. I put a hole in it, you know, it was pop. And I went out and took pictures, actually took my hand next to these hailstones to see how actual big they were. I mean, and had we been outside, you know, I mean, that could have done some damage. And obviously these hailstones are even bigger, and there certainly are on record proof that hailstones can be baseball, softball size. You get hit by one of those, I mean, that can kill you. There's no two ways about it. And so you think, well, you know, this really isn't a miracle. Because it's just a hailstorm. And it just happened to be some really, really big hail. Yeah. Well, think about it here for a minute. Not only did the hailstorm start when the guys had a panic attack and started running, but it was selective hail. That's the interesting thing about the whole thing. Did you notice none of the Israelites got hit? It, you know, God was aiming. You know, and he got the enemies, and they're the ones that got hit by the hail, and none of the Israelites got hit by the hail. I don't know. I got to call this a bona fide miracle. I'm sorry. I'm just going to have to do that, and so there you go. So it says, now, we're not done with miracles. In fact, you know what? The greatest is saved for last. Look at verse 12. At that time, Joshua spoke to the Lord in the day when the Lord gave the Amorites over to the sons of Israel and said in the sight of Israel, Son, stand still at Gibeon, and moon in the valley of Aijalon, and the sun stood still. And what it means is, it literally in the Hebrew, it means it speaks of a retardation or a slowing down. It doesn't necessarily mean that it went, you know, sort of a thing. It means it just became extremely slow, and it says, the sun stood still and the moon stopped until the nation took vengeance on their enemies. Is this not written in the book of Jasher? The sun stopped in the midst of the heaven and did not hurry to set for about a whole day. There has been no day like it before or since when the Lord heeded the voice of a man, for the Lord fought for Israel. Wow. Now, just what did take place here? I mean, like I said, there's maybe some hints from the Hebrew, but just exactly what did take place here, we don't know. You know, whether an actual day was lost in astronomical terms, and I don't know anything about astronomical terms, but or whether I've heard some people try to describe it as it there was a miracle of the refraction of light, so that it just appeared to be light for a longer period of time, or what? You know what? It doesn't matter. God did a miracle. Now, I'll tell you something, that this reference here in the Bible has come under extreme attack from people over the centuries, and people love to point at this and say, you know, this is one of the proofs that, you know, the Bible can't possibly be true, because there's no possible way that the sun could stay in the sky for an entire day beyond and not set for a day and you know, within a 24-hour period or whatever, and it's just not possible. But you know, I've always thought that if you believe the very first verse of the Bible, then you don't have any trouble with this one either. The very first verse of the Bible says, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And if that's true, and if you believe it, you don't have any problem with that. If you believe that in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, then what's the big deal about this? You know, if he truly created the heavens and the earth, he can do anything. It's his creation. He can do with it what he wants. I love what Spurgeon says. He is to quote him. He says, how he did it is no question for us. It's not ours to try and soften down miracles, but to glorify God in them. I think that's a good quote. And then Warren Wiersbe writes this. I love this. He says, if God can't perform the miracle described in Joshua 10, then he can't perform any miracle. And he is therefore imprisoned in his own creation, unable to use or suspend the very laws he built into it. And he said, I have a difficult time believing in that kind of God who is limited by his own creation. Remember, God lives outside of creation. He lives outside of space and time. He lives outside of all that has been made. He is uncreated. All that you and I are and exist in is created. And God is outside of it. And he is not limited by it. He controls it. It does not limit him. He can limit it if he wants to. And it's really the same miracle-working power that would cause God to respond to Joshua's prayer and lengthen a day so that it became the equivalent of 2 days before the sun actually went down, or for Jesus to reach out and touch a leper and say, be clean, and to have him have his skin made whole. There's no difference. No difference at all. It's suspending the laws of nature. It's suspending that which would otherwise naturally occur. You know? Verse 15 says, so Joshua returned and all Israel with him to the camp of Gilgal. Okay, here we get, this is interesting now. Verse 16. It says, these five kings fled and hid themselves in the cave at Makeda. And it was told to Joshua, the five kings have been found hidden in the cave at Makeda. And Joshua said, fine, roll large stones over the mouth of the cave and set men by it to guard them, but don't stay there yourselves. Pursue your enemies. Attack their rear guard. Do not let them enter their cities, for the Lord your God has given them into your hand. He's saying basically, we can deal with these kings later. Just put a stone over the mouth of the cave. They won't be going anywhere. And when Joshua and the sons of Israel had finished striking them with a great blow until they were wiped out, and when the remnant that remained of them had entered into their fortified cities, and what that means is some of them actually got away, and they got into some fortified cities, but Joshua let them go. He said, don't worry about it. We're going to take those cities eventually anyway, so they have nowhere to run. It says, then all the people, verse 21, returned safe to Joshua in the camp at Makeda, and not a man moved his tongue against any of the people of Israel, meaning nobody badmouthed Israel anymore. It's like, okay, you know what? We just learned this isn't a fluke. Jericho and Ai, that wasn't a fluke. They just defeated 10 kings. And Joshua said, open the mouth of the cave and bring those five kings out to me from the cave. And they did so. And they brought those five kings out to him from the cave, the king of Jerusalem, Hebron, Jarmuth, Lachish, and Eglon. And when they brought those kings out to Joshua, Joshua summoned all the men of Israel and said to the chiefs of the men of war who had gone with him, come near, put your feet on the necks of these kings. And then they came near and put their feet on their necks. And Joshua said to them, do not be afraid or dismayed. Be strong and courageous, for thus the Lord will do to all your enemies against whom you fight. And that's a symbolic picture, by the way. And by the way, if that sounds cruel to you, you need to remember that these kings are pagan kings, part of a pagan culture that had become so diseased and so filthy in their lifestyle and in their way of life that God, the only way to save the land was to rid the land of these people. And you need to look at these kings like we look at sin in our lives. And you know, you can't walk out the promises of God with about five kings hiding in a cave somewhere, you know, just kind of hanging out. You got to get rid of them. Just like sin. You know, Jesus talked about a pretty radical way of eliminating sin in our lives too, didn't he? He talked about, you know, if your right eye causes you to sin, gouge it out and throw it away. You didn't want to think about that. You don't want to think about what, you know, the implications of that. Well, obviously he's not telling you to mutilate your bodies, but he's talking about that radical response to sin that you and I are to have. Don't let it live. And furthermore, put your foot on its neck. That's a symbolic military sign of victory and dominance. It's to basically say this: you will dominate your enemies. Your enemies will not dominate you. And for you and I, that means you will dominate your sin. Your sin will not dominate you. Think about it, people. Think about the sins that cause you to stumble. And you know what they are. I don't have to tell you what they are. You know. Well, I don't tell you because I don't know myself what they are in your life. I know what they are in mine. I know about the things that challenge me and tempt me and cause me to struggle. Think for a moment yourself about the things that cause you to do that. Now, picture in your mind with your foot on the neck of those sins. That's the picture God wants you to have. That you, through Christ, will walk in victory against the enemies of sin, the enemies of the world, the enemies of Satan and his minions that come against you to cause you to sin and to cause you to walk away from the Lord. Your foot is on their neck. And it says in verse 26 that afterward Joshua struck them and put them to death, and he hanged them on five trees. And they hung on the trees until evening, but at the time of the going down of the sun, Joshua commanded, and they took them down from the trees and threw them into the cave where they'd hidden them, and that cave kind of became their grave, their tomb. And they set large stones over the mouth of the cave, which remain to this very day, of course, the day that this was written. As for Makeda, Joshua captured it on that day and struck it and its king with the edge of the sword, and he devoted to destruction every person in it. He left nothing remaining, and he did to the king of Makeda just as he had done to the king of Jericho. And then in the verses that follow in this chapter, they simply go through and they talk about each city in its turn. It next goes to Libna, fought against them. Lord gave it into their hand, struck down the edge of the sword, every person in it, left nothing remaining, killed the king. Verse 31, Joshua did everything like that from to Lachish, laid siege to it, fought against it, gave Lachish into their hands, captured it. Second day, struck it with the edge of the sword, every person in it, just like they'd done at Libna. And Horam, king of Gezer, came up to help Lachish. Joshua struck him and his people, left none remaining. Then Joshua, verse 34, and all Israel with him passed on from Lachish to Eglon. Same thing. Laid siege to it, fought against it, captured it, struck it with the edge of the sword, devoted the people to destruction. Boom. Verse 36, went against Hebron, fought against it, captured it, struck it with the edge of the sword. All its kings, towns, every person in it, none remaining, devoted to destruction. Verse 38, then turned to Debir, fought against it, captured it. King and all of its towns, struck them with the edge of the sword, devoted to destruction, every person in it, left none remaining. Just like they'd done everywhere else, they did it to Debir. And then it says, verse 40, so Joshua struck the whole land, the hill country and the Negeb and the lowland and the slopes and all their kings. He left none remaining, but devoted to destruction all that breathed, just as the Lord God of Israel commanded. And Joshua struck them from Kadesh Barnea as far as Gaza, and all the country of Goshen as far as Gibeon. And Joshua captured all these kings and their land at one time because the Lord God of Israel fought for Israel. I like that. Read the last verse along with me here. This is pretty good. Remember I brought this out? Then Joshua returned where? To the camp at Gilgal. Joshua and all Israel, what are they going to do? They're going to go back to the cross. They're going to go back to the place of remembrance. They're going to go back to the place of recommitment. They're going to go back to the place of reflection, the place of death and resurrection. They're going back. And that's where we always got to go back. We got to go back. Always go back to the cross in our lives. Go back to living for Jesus. Go back to remembering. That's why we do communion, you know. When we do communion, we do it once a month around here. You know, it's just once a month. There's nothing in the Bible that says do it once a month. It just says as often as you do, do it in remembrance. So, you know, why do we do that? We do that to go back to the cross, to go back and remember. Go back. We're going to go back and just remind ourselves what happened there. Because that's the source, isn't it? That's our source.
The teaching you've just watched contains notes and prayer points. The video play window contains a link for you to click on. It's circled in red. You will be redirected to the notes and prayer points archive.